Today, the lesson will be mainly focused on the exam that was given on May 19, 2020, the last exam, and in particular on the solution of the problems, the questions, and the issues on which it consists. As you can see, typically the exam is made of a first question that is related to a piece of code written in ARM assembly language, and the course question is basically to interpret the function of the set of operations that are performed through that code. That is, the solution is not to translate every instruction in what this instruction does, because this is very elementary, but is but consists in providing a general vision of the operation implemented. But we will see. I prefer to start with the other two pillars on which typically the exam is based, that is the group of questions and the process that foresees a digital interfacing with a microprocessor. Let's consider this first one, and let's read the text of the exam just to interpret it. The problem proposed by the question number three, the process, let's say, is related to the recent pandemic that changed completely our style of life, and in particular to pulmonary respiratory devices. Let's read it together. Respiratory failure is one of the most common complications related to COVID-19. The infection triggered by the new coronavirus that emerged in China. As many as 10% of affected patients need intensive care treatment, basically to be treated with mechanical ventilation or artificial ventilation, and support their breathing. This life-saving procedure takes place through a medical device that is present in each intensive care unit, the pulmonary ventilator. The pulmonary ventilator is a medical device that has the purpose of integrating or replacing the activity of the muscles related to breathing. It has the diaphragm and the intercostals. Simply put, the mechanical ventilator is a device designed to blow air or gas mixtures into the patient's lung with a specific frequency and with finely calibrated pressures. Stop insufflation and allow gas exchange between the alveoli and blood capillaries. Promote exhalation with the release of gas, carbon dioxide, which occurs due to the elastic nature of the lungs. Start a new cycle that allows to replicate in all respects the natural lung respiration. Modern lung ventilators automatically calculate the volume of the air to be conveyed to the patient based on the recorded pressures. The air is blown into the rib cage through instruments that are typical of the so-called intubation. The main one is the endotracheal tube, which is inserted into the patient's mouth and which, as its name suggests, passes through the trachea. In practice, trace the path to direct the air directly into the lungs. Intubation is always practiced after having put the patient to sleep, so she doesn't notice the insertion and removal of the tube, considered an invasive procedure. The passage from the forced inspiratory phase to the expiratory one is obtained through the opening and closing of the suitable valves, as shown in the figure. The mixed air is blown into the lungs through a bellow pump, see the figure, moved by an electromagnetic actuator, and by monitoring the patient's ECG, the frequency of the actuator is automatically adjusted based on the heart rate acquired. Now the question is, how many beats are used by the microprocessor to measure the process variable with 2% precision and to drive the actuator together with the opening closing holes of the valves? That's the question. And to answer to it, we need to make some considerations related to the structure of the process and the nature of the transducer and the actuators that are employed into it. First of all, let's consider the measurement of the process variable that we have to acquire. The process variable is, as the text says, the ECG frequency. On the other hand, this frequency is clearly related to the frequency of the air blowing, that is, to the frequency of the pump driven by the electromagnetic actuator. Therefore, we can consider the frequency of the air, the real variable that is monitored, and the frequency of the air pumped, of the air blown into the respiratory machinery, we could say, of the patient, is clearly related to the flow rate. Therefore, we can perform the measurement with a flow meter, and we can assume that it is possible to associate it to the ECG with a suitable lookup table or every other kind of a priori knowledge it is possible to imagine. Among the several flow meters that we know, we can choose those that are characterized by an analog output. Perhaps you remember from the course of mechatronics the electromagnetic flow meter, for example, or the so-called Venturi meter, another example. And in this case, we will need 6 bits for the conversion plus 2 for the start of conversion and of conversion commands. Remember that precision equal to the 2% means that we need 50 levels in the analog to digital conversion to respect the required precision. 50, since 2% corresponds to 100 as a full-scale possible value and 2 as the tolerance allowed in this case. The logarithm on base 2 of 50 is 6, because 2 power 6 is 64. That is the highest value close to 50, but greater than it. Otherwise, if we would consider only 5 bits, we would have 32 levels, and the corresponding precision is not enough for the requirement of the problem. As an alternative, however, we know also that there are flow meters whose output is digital. For example, if we consider a turbine, we clearly remember that the measurement of the flow rate is transformed in the measurement of an angular velocity, because the flow rate is equal to the product of the velocity of a fluid times the area of the section of the tube into which the fluid is passing. Therefore, if we imagine to use, for example, incremental encoder, in that case the number of the bits needed for the precision is 2, because 2 are the channels in output from the encoder. and the required precision will be related to the number of the windows that the two circular crowns will feature, just to allow a suitable count of pulses that will correspond to the required accuracy. But the number of the bits that a microprocessor should devote to the management of the process is not only related to the measurement. In this specific case, we have, as the text says, actuators that are responsible for opening and closing the valves and also for driving the pump. Let's consider this last issue, and let's consider the fact that the actuator is electromagnetic and its movement is bidirectional. Therefore, we can drive it with a circuit that should include a TRIAC device. And in the solution that I have prepared for you, I have drawn a picture that represents a possible solution. If you look at the picture, you clearly recognize a circuit that we have described during the lessons, but with a small modification in the zero crossing circuit. In other words, if we want to power supply through a TRIAC a suitable load that in this case is an electromagnetic actuator, and in particular we want to assure the bidirectional movement of the actuator itself, we must provide both negative and positive supply to the load, in this case to the actuator that we are using. Therefore, we assumed that a TRIAC is necessary. But in the solution that we have explained in the lesson, the circuit was able only to drive a TRIAC as or as silicon control rectifier in the positive waveform, and this is not the case. Therefore, the modification that I have introduced in the circuit, if you remember the situation, you know that a microprocessor will exit a suitable number that is converted by a DAC into a voltage, and this voltage is able to keep a P-channel MOS active, and in particular this voltage is able to influence, to establish the current that crosses the resistor R, that crosses the P-channel MOS and will go into the capacitor so as to reach a suitable threshold that is able to trigger a unijunction transistor with a very intense and short current that is reflected by the magnetic coupling into the gate of the TRIAC, so switching on it. We know that the current is intense, as we said, and short, therefore the signal that arrives on the gate of the TRIAC is a real pulse that enables it to work in a particular moment of the half period of the alternate AC signal that is provided by the power supply point. And this moment is depending directly on the value of the current and therefore on the value of the voltage set by the microprocessor. This is possible because the N-channel MOS that you see in the picture, in the circuit, is kept not active in the positive waveform of the AC signal by the zero crossing circuit, while in the negative one this N-channel MOS is active. and therefore absorbs the current coming from the P channel, since the resistance that is presented to the current is very lower with respect to the impedance provided by the capacitor, and prevent the capacitor from charging in the negative wave of the AC signal, because the silicon control rectifier in that wave doesn't work. Remember, in fact, that we have conceived the circuit with the silicon control rectifier. But in this case, the situation is different, because we need to be able to switch on the triac both in the positive and in the negative waveform. Therefore, I modified the zero crossing circuit with that XOR port, into which one input comes from the operational amplifier that is related to the AC signal, and another input comes from a microprocessor on the basis of the time and the phase that sets the activation or the not activation of the n-channel MOS. In fact, if we consider the alternate AC signal, that signal is brought to the inputs of the operational amplifier, and we can conclude that during the positive waveform, the output of the operational amplifier will be logic zero, since the negative input is greater than the positive one. Therefore, we must charge the capacitor, and we must keep the n-channel not active. This means that its gate must be set to zero, to logic level low, and therefore the command that is put in output by the microprocessor is zero. In a zero, in a XOR gate, two inputs at zero will produce an output that is zero. Therefore, the current charges the capacitor, the UJT will be switched on, and the triac will be activated at the proper time. But immediately after this, the command of the microprocessor is switched to 1, so as in the remaining part of the half period of the signal, the capacitor will be not charged again. The microprocessor is able to do this because it knows at what tau it is necessary to switch up the triac, and this interval can be evaluated internally to the microprocessor by a suitable timer. Therefore, in this second part of the half period of the AC signal, the n-channel MOS will be active, and the current will go to the ground through it and not through the capacitor. A similar situation must be carried out during the negative wave of the AC signal. In this case, the output of the operational amplifier is positive, because the negative input is lower than the positive one. And this means that we want to charge the capacitor, therefore the gate of the n-channel MOS must be kept to zero, and this requires that the command signal coming from the microprocessor is 1. 1-1 as inputs of a XOR gate will produce a zero output. Therefore, the current will charge the capacitor, and the UJT will be switched on, and the same will happen to the triac. In the negative, I repeat, wave of the alternate signal. But after this, we want to prevent the capacitor to charge again, therefore we switch on the n-channel MOS, and this is done by the microprocessor by setting the command signal to zero. 0, 1 as inputs to a XOR gate will turn out into a logic 1 output that keeps the n-channel MOS active. So with this very simple change in the original circuit, we are able to activate the TRIAC and the connected load both in the positive and in the negative wave of the AC signal. And looking at the process, we are able to drive a movement of the pump in a certain direction and into the opposite one. How many bits this circuit requires to the microprocessor? First of all, we have the DAC bits, that is, the two start of conversion and end of conversion bits for the handshake protocol between DAC and microprocessor, and the bits related to the precision that in the text is not explicitly mentioned, but could be argued to be at least equal to the conversion of the process variable precision, therefore again 6 bits. Together these ones, we must add also the command bit to properly set the output of the XOR gate. And finally, the two valves, how to manage them. In the text, it is not specified what kind of valves we are using, that is, if they are on-off, all open, all closed, or if their whole is regulated, for example, through the use of a motor. Clearly, if the two valves are on-off, in this case we can imagine a suitable couple of switches that are able to drive them, that is, a couple of MOS devices managed by a couple of bits. One can argue that when a valve is closed, the other is open, and vice versa, so could conclude that only one bit is necessary to manage the two valves. But consider that we need also a forced pause between the opening of a valve and the closing of the other one. Therefore, this situation is better managed by using two bits instead of the one. As an alternative, we said that it is possible to use gate valves, and in this case the opening-closing phases will be managed by a motor with a screw. Now the problem is, what kind of motor? A stepper motor or a direct current motor? In the first case, a stepper motor, that probably could be considered better, due also to the dimensions that typically these motors have with respect to a DC motor. In this case, I repeat, the bits are required to drive the power supply timer and the flip-flop regulators of the signal V13 and V24 that will drive the inductors of the stepper motor itself. Clearly, the bits that are related to the timer depend on the precision with which we want to set the time measurement, and therefore we can again make the same consideration as before, that is 6 bits, just to be aligned with the precision of the measurement of the process variable. For what concerns instead the flip-flop regulator, the same consideration can be done, since the precision of the time with which we want to switch the signals that drive the inductors will be the same as for all the others, let's say, digital variables, digital parameters that are used into this kind of process. On the other end, if we decide to use a direct current motor, we need to drive the motor with a circuit that is similar to the previous one, again with a triac, because probably we want to preserve a possibility to perform a bidirectional movement, and this allows us to repeat the same considerations as before. But we need also a transducer, a position transducer, that will provide us the position to the valve so as to regulate the motor. In fact, in this case, the control of the motor will be performed through a closed loop ring, while instead, with a stepper motor, the control is open ring. And now let's come to the questions that are written into the text of the exam and must receive an answer. The first is related to the circuit that we called silicon controlled rectifier emulator. We described it in the case of a resistive load. In this case, the question is, what is the transfer function that should be emulated by the silicon control rectifier in case of an inductive load? That is, what does it change if the load is inductive? First of all, let's take a look to the slide of the actuators section, into which we explained the general idea in case of a resistive load. If you remember, we started from a very simple concept that was, let's emulate the behavior of the silicon control rectifier, in that case, resistive load, and let's obtain in such a way a suitable voltage. And we compare this voltage with a fixed threshold with an operational amplifier, when the output of the operational amplifier will change from low to high, this means that the emulator reaches the threshold that we have fixed, and therefore with that signal we can activate, we can switch up the SCR, because we are sure that the threshold that we have decided is what it is possible to reach by the emulator after a time tau from the zero crossing point of the AC waveform, that will provide, that will correspond to the characteristic curve the SCR has when the load is resistive. In that picture, in fact, we reported this characteristic, this transfer function, Vm with respect tau, that is more or less a cosine function with some differences at the beginning and at the end of the half period. Remember that in the case of the SCR, we can use it only in the positive way. And we built the emulator just to reproduce the kind of curve, so as defining a function that was Vm0, a fixed voltage provided by a suitable accumulator, minus the integral function of a suitable voltage divided by Rc in the time. The integral function was provided by that capacitor in reaction to the operational amplifier to which the resistor R is connected. And after a certain set of considerations, we concluded that this network, this circuit, is able to emulate with a certain degree of approximation, but in an acceptable way, the behavior of a silicon controlled rectifier. Now, looking at the behavior of the current that crosses a silicon controlled rectifier when the load is inductive, we see that basically that is the integral function of the ratio of the provided voltage to the SCR divided by the value of the inductive impedance. This integral function is evaluated between starting time and ending time that we will comment into a minute. So the formula that is written into the solution is quite useful for us because we remember that the input signal to the SCR is an alternate waveform signal, therefore we can express it as a VP sine of omega t in the t. The inductive impedance is L, and the integral function starts from the moment into which we switch on the triac, or we want to switch on the triac, up to the moment into which we want to switch off the triac itself. And you remember that a specific property when the load is inductive is that the current will continue to flow through the SCR even in the negative wave of the AC signal into which the SCR should be off. This is a particular effect due to the fact that the inductor is an accumulator of energy, and this energy, that is this current, is accumulated up to the SCR is active, that is up to the end of the positive waveform. During the negative waveform into which the SCR should be off, this energy is not accumulated but is released under the form of current, and therefore the current will continue to flow up to a certain instant of time that more or less is symmetric with respect to the zero crossing point of the moment into which the conduction phase started. Therefore, if this moment is tau, the moment into which the current flow will finish is t, the period, minus tau itself. And this means that the circuit that we can carry out to drive the inductive load is the one shown in the solution, to which we of course add a resistor that replaces of course the SCR. And the voltage taken at the extremities of the resistor will be the voltage value that must be inserted into the negative input of the operational amplifier, just as to obtain that moment into which we want to reach the fixed threshold value, and therefore through the operational amplifier output we want to activate the silicon controlled rectifier gate. The next question is related instead to a CAN bus, and in particular to a situation that occurs during a marathon, into which the athlete pass close to detection points that are displaced, spread along the track every kilometer. Every athlete is characterized by a number, and this number is transmitted from the detection point in the same format for all the detection points, that is the CAN format with the 4G technology, to a central computer that monitors the rates the participants, and provides statistics, estimations, and more and more and more. If the number of the athletes is 100, what are the maximum and minimum frequencies of the information that are received by the central computer? To answer this question, let's suppose that the identifier of the athlete, that is the number, is a byte. So it's okay, because 8 bits can represent a number from 1 up to 100. Let's suppose, moreover, that the worst case is when, probably at the beginning of the race, all the 100 athletes contemporaneously arrived at the checkpoint, and the best case is when only one arrives at the checkpoint. That is, the worst case, worst in the sense that we are obliged to send, to manage a lot of information to the computer, therefore we must assure a suitable throughput, a suitable communication rate. On the contrary, the best is when we have to transmit only one information at a time. Okay, in both the cases, the information that must be sent to the computer should arrive before the athletes will arrive at the next checkpoint. Therefore, we need to estimate what is the time from one checkpoint to the other, considering the average velocity that these athletes can provide, and the distance that in the text is said to be 1 kilometer. If we assume a velocity equal to 5 kilometers per hour, we have more or less 3 minutes for sending all the information before the next point is reached. If we use the CAN protocol, remember that the protocol requires that a request frame, an interframe, and a data frame are sent for every information that we want to communicate. That is 44 bits for the request frame plus 3 bits interframe and 52 bits data frame. In this case, we have assumed, first of all, that identifiers are characterized by 11 bits. Second, no error passive notes and no bus idle sequences are present in the IF interframe. And the last assumption is related to the fact that for every athlete, for every participant, a handshake protocol is implemented. That is, for every participant we have the RF, the IF, and the DF that are put on the network. Otherwise, another kind of assumption could be that the data frame contains all the numbers of all the athletes that are passing in that checkpoint. Different possibilities. The number of the bits that must be received is, in the worst case, 100 times 99. 99 is the sum of 44, 3, and 52. When instead we have only one athlete that must be, let's say, communicated to the central computer, we need only 99 bits to be sent. Assuming that the velocity of the CAN bus is 1 megabit per second, the time necessary in the two cases is 9.9 milliseconds and 99 microseconds, that is well below the time limit found before. Consider also that 1 megabit per second is a very low velocity, because if we consider, as mentioned in the text, the 4G technology, the throughput that can be reached is even better or higher. Now we have a couple of questions that are related to the characteristics of the ARM processor. The first is related to the fact that the management of a fast interrupt is typically faster and lighter than the management of a normal IRQ service, of course, in ARM. Just to answer to this question, it is necessary to have in mind the slide 109 in the embedded systems section. In fact, first of all, FIQ features a number of banked registers greater than IRQ. And this means that in this case we have a set of registers from R8 to R14 specifically devoted to the interrupt management and not shared with others. This means that when it is necessary to perform a context switch due to an interrupt, FIQ will have immediately available a set of memory banks devoted to its own management, while in the other cases it is necessary to save them into a suitable area, for example a stack, and after the service it will be necessary to recover them from the stack area. So we have an overhead, clearly. FIQ, moreover, is characterized by a vectorized interrupt, and in this case the vector is the last entry into the vector table. FIQ handler, therefore, can be located directly at the vector location and run sequentially from that address without the need for a branch with its associated delays. This means also that the length of the routine will be not limited by the next address of a location that contains the routine address for another interrupt service, because this is the last one. If the system finally has a cache, the vector table and the handler of the fast interrupt may be all locked down in one block, and this will speed further the management. The other question related to the ARM architecture is about the return address from a data abort and a fetch abort. In case of data abort, the jump back amount is 8 bytes from the content of the link register. Instead, in case of a FIQ or IRQ or fetch abort, the amount of the jump back is 4 bytes from the content of the link register, and the question is why this is possible. Consider that the data abort happens during the execution of the instruction when the third stage of the pipeline is active. We remember, in fact, that the ARM family that we have considered is characterized by a three stages pipeline. The first is devoted to the fetch of an instruction, the second to the coding of that instruction, and the third one to the execution of, let's say, the tasks related to that instruction. In this way, at every, let's say, clock cycle, at every step, it is better to say, three instructions are in progress. Therefore, I repeat, data abort is a situation that is related to the access to the content of a variable that is not allowed, that is not possible to have, but this problem raises up at the execution stage of the pipeline. And this pipeline corresponds to an address of the instruction that is two steps before the one that is actually fetched in the fetch stage of the pipeline. Since an instruction is 32-bit long, that is 4 bytes long, to re-execute the instruction that caused the data abort in the hypothesis that the interrupt service routine is able to solve the problem will require to load the program counter with the content of the link register that contains the PC of the present situation into which we are interrupting the execution of the flux of the instructions, minus 8, because we refer to the specific instruction that caused the problem. Instead, if we consider the fetch situation, we have a different point of view, because the fetch abort occurs when an instruction is fetched from the memory. And since the program counter has been contemporaneously upgraded to PC plus 4, in case of abort, it is necessary to jump back to the instruction that has not been fetched, and this means that the program counter must be decreased, must be diminished by 4 to repeat the instruction. The same consideration must be done also for the fast and normal interrupt management, since, as you can find in the slide 91 of the embedded system section, FIQ and IRQ are generated when an instruction is finished, that is, only after the end of the execution of an instruction. This means that the program counter has been already upgraded to the next instruction that must be executed, that must be processed. But the idea is that the interrupt occurred, we finish the instruction, we serve the interrupt, and in case we execute again the instruction into which the interrupt occurred. Therefore, we must diminish the program counter by 4, because we are addressing the instruction immediately following the FIQ IRQ interrupted one, and we will re-execute it. This is the reason why the amount of the jump back is the same of the fetch abort, but is different from that in case of data abort.